8:25 a.m., my colleague Mrs. Grace took over for me. I introduced her to the Arab and told him that she would now stay with him instead of me. He agreed because I had already negotiated this with him beforehand. He also agreed to a further discussion with the chief of police and the mayor.
Last episode, we were talking about how the terrorists intruded the Olympic Village, assaulted the Israeli team and killed the first of their 11 hostages almost right away. The terrorists set an ultimatum. 200 Palestinians had to be released from prison in Israel. If not, the hostages were to be killed. Time limit, 12 o'clock noon. There are two women who are highly underestimated so far when talking about the history of the Palestinian attack against Israel's Olympic team in Munich. Their names, Gertrud Lauterbach and Anneliese Gress. Lauterbach started her shift at 11 p.m. in the night of December 4th to September 5th. She was a criminal investigator by profession. During the early morning, she heard shots. She went and looked at what happened. She was amongst the first on site. She conveyed between the terrorists and state authorities. Before noon, she was relieved by her colleague Anneliese Gress, criminal detective as well. Both Lauterbach and Gress lived in the German state of North Rhine-Westphalia. Both had been delegated to the Olympic Games to serve as so-called Olympic hostesses. They were dressed in light blue costume uniforms, kind of typical stewardess look of the 1970s. Pictures show Olympic hostesses always smiling when guiding foreigners on their way. Olympic hostesses are always depicted as young and pretty. One of those Olympic hostesses went famous. The Swedish king fell in love with her, took her with him to Sweden and married her. Her name was Sylvia Sommerlath. But no one remembers the name Gertrud Lauterbach. Anneliese Gress later at least was awarded with the German Medal of Honor. But this was just a small event covered mainly by some local newspapers. But it was Lauterbach and Gress who didn't run away. They constantly held a communications channel to the terrorists, even when they were being threatened with arms. They hardly had any support from their superiors. On the contrary, they supported them when they asked for information to have something to say when holding press conferences. In her interrogation statement, Anneliese Gress described what happened during the time before noon, when she took over until the night when the terrorists took hostage and moved to Fürstenfeldbruck. Her testimony is amongst the most detailed sources of information about what happened during this day. German authorities hold it classified until the year 2041, for whatever reason. I was allowed to have a look at it and to take notes, which I did extensively, but writing it down completely, word by word. This episode is based on Anneliese Gress' testimony being completed by further documents from the archives.
September 5th, 1972. I started my shift at 7 a.m. at Block G of the Olympic Village. When I reached our office, I was already informed about what happened. I learned that terrorists had taken Israelis as hostages and that one or two people had been killed. I learned that a colleague of the C shift who served during the night, Mrs. Lauterbach, stood in front of the house where this happened and wanted to be relieved. Although I felt that this shouldn't be our duty, I said to a colleague that we should go there to look what was going on. So I took a walkie-talkie and went with my colleague to the Konolistrasse number 31. To be correct, I did not pick up a walkie-talkie because no device was available. I didn't get one until I arrived there. The colleague I went with was not allowed to enter the site. She was stopped at a security post. I myself was not able to walk the place straight away. I had to walk around a security post that didn't allow me to enter as well. I surrounded the area from the southern side back to Konolistrasse. Miss Lauterbach was standing in front of the building at the northern side. When I joined her, it was 10 to 8 in the morning.
Geheimakte 1972. Das Olympia-Attentat in München.
Hallo Tunis, wir haben die israelische Mannschaft in unserer Gewalt.
My brother came to do sport in the Olympics and they were murdered there.
Die ganze Geschichte, investigativ recherchiert. Bisher unveröffentlichtes Material.
I was contacted by a German journalist, Christoph Lemmer.
Geheimakte 1972. Die ganze Geschichte. Episode 7. Anneliese Gräß und der Überfall.
When I arrived at the object, I didn't see any of the terrorists. But when I started talking with my colleague, a terrorist came walking through the door. I learned that he was their leader. Mrs. Lauterbach immediately approached him and told him that I was a colleague of hers. She said I now would stay here. Then she handed me over her walkie-talkie.
On this morning in Tel Aviv, Mark Slavin's parents know that their son is about to have his first Olympic competition at 10 o'clock. He is a wrestler. His chances to win an Olympic medal are good. He and his family migrated to Israel just shortly before from Belarus. Here's Mark's sister Mika about what happened this morning in Tel Aviv.
They decided at 8 o'clock to go to the bank and to be back home at 10 o'clock. They were approaching the bank and my mom see a newspaper and Muni Weinberg, Mark's coach, is on the newspaper, and then she's telling my dad, how can it be that the coach is on the newspaper and not Mark? So she's buying this copy of a newspaper. She's going into the bank. They didn't know Hebrew. She's asking in Yiddish, can you tell me what happened? Why Moshe Weinberg is on the newspaper? And then they tell her, what, you didn't hear the news? All the 11 sportsmen were kidnapped by terrorists. And this is how my parents find out.
File notice, 8:35 a.m. K.A., Commissioner candidate Dauchner calls and says that a telephone surveillance is needed for the five line in the building of the Israeli sports team. 8:45 a.m. Notification of the postal service.
For your understanding, at this time Germany didn't have a telecommunications company on its own. Telephone services were provided by the state-run postal service.
At my rebuke to the terrorist what a crap he was doing here, he replied that I was not within their procedure and that I didn't have to fear anything. He said that this was not against Germans and that he wanted to free Palestinian prisoners out of an Israeli prison in exchange with his hostages. On my question how he made it into the Olympic Village, he laughed and said, I should have known him already, since he had worked in the village. He said he wanted to show me his employee's ID, but didn't bring it. On further question, he said he worked in the milk bar. I replied I knew that there were only women working in the milk bar. He insisted he had worked there. He said once he was even dancing in front of the milk bar. I said, oh my God, which he replied saying, if I had something against people just having fun. After this short conversation, at this point I want to say that I didn't know his name at any time.
However, we know his name. It was the man who was called Issa. His real name, Lutif Afif. But no one in Germany knew his real name at that time.
Here is how I can describe him. Age 35. This is what he told me. 1 meter and 64 centimeters tall. Very slim, black hair. Slightly wavy hair to the nape of the neck. Wearing a light yellow straw hat. His face was painted with, I perceived as brown shoe polish. He wore large sunglasses with horn rims and metal temples. His cheekbones stood out. His cheeks were sunken. He was dressed in a gray and beige suit, sportively cut with a zipper at the front. I remember that he had two breast pockets folded in the middle. The left breast pocket had a damage, could have been a cut. I asked him about it and if he was injured. He waved off with his hand and said that nothing happened. To my opinion, this came from the fighting in the house. It was a very clear cut.
Anneliese Gress gathered much more information about Issa. Very personal information. And all of it was true, as investigation later found out.
I learned about his person that he was 35 years old and the son of a rich Arab and a Jewish woman. He had three younger brothers, all members of the Black September organization. His 32-year-old brother I also met, as mentioned. The two others were imprisoned in Israel. He said he didn't know if they were still alive. His father was a capitalist and, as he said, against what he did. His mother, on the other side, agreed to his work, although being Jewish. I did not get his parents' names and addresses. Although being Arab, he said he was Christian. He believed in God. He told me he was born in Nazareth and lived in tents since 1948. He said he attended a school graduating him for university. 1958, he said he went to Berlin, Germany, for studying and that he became a fully educated engineer, and then studying psychology in addition. He had been engaged to a German girl in Berlin, but then it didn't work out, so his words. I didn't hear about this girl's name and address. He said he worked in France for 5 years as an engineer. He said he made lots of money there and lived a lavish life. But in the long run, he didn't like this. So he was looking for something else. His big life goal then became to help conquer land for the Palestinians.
Gress listened carefully and even noticed a special characteristic in the way he was speaking.
He spoke pretty good German, but with a remarkable French accent, and he often said, oh la la.
But her first encounter with Issa was threatening, she testified.
When I saw him for the first time, he had a hand grenade in his hand. The grenade was green, had a gold-colored framing, and a ring which one could lay aside. I assume this was the trigger. He didn't have the hand grenade in his hand every time. Occasionally, he came through the door without any arms at all. I repeatedly asked him not to walk around next to me with his arms, sometimes kind of small talk, sometimes straight talk. He answered then laughingly that I didn't have anything to fear.
Back to what happened on September 5th.
As I remember, it was 8:45 a.m. when the police president, Dr. Schreiber, and the German Olympic chef of organization, Mr. Tröger, both accompanied by a criminal detective, walked to the house. I don't know anymore if these gentlemen had told the terrorist in advance that they intended to visit him. Usually they kept waiting in a distance, waved to me or called me, asking if the delegation was allowed to come closer to the house. I then went to the door, knocked, and asked if they were allowed to join. They always had to be announced this way. Whenever the leader negotiated with them, he was armed with a hand grenade and being secured with machine guns from the balcony. All I can say about the first negotiation is that they were talking about the paper sheets. I don't remember that they closed any kind of agreement. But I do remember that the time for the ultimatum, 12 o'clock noon, remained untouched. This first talk took a couple of minutes only. Now I want to tell about what happened when Dr. Schreiber and his people left again at around 8:45 a.m. After another, let's say, 15 minutes, the head of the Egyptian delegation came to the house. With him were the criminal detective with Dr. Schreiber or Mr. Tröger. They were negotiating in Arabic language. I didn't understand a single word. I learned that this other Arabic man was Egyptian because the terrorist's leader told me. They were talking just a couple of minutes. I assume that this talk ended without a result.
Shortly after, policemen who are guarding the back door report. Something's going on inside.
9 a.m. Bavaria 53 to Bavaria 50. There are three men carrying machine guns in the entrance of the basement. It looks like an imminent breakout attempt. 9:10 a.m. There are still three men in the basement. 9:10 a.m. There is an attempt to reach the public prosecutor, Amon, regarding the order for telephone surveillance. No one answers. 9:12 a.m. Criminal Inspector Seiler is informed that for a telephone surveillance, appropriate equipment is needed. 9:20 a.m. Seiler has contacted French officials. He informs that equipment will arrive shortly.
Befriended office. This is always a secret service, in this case the German BND, Bundesnachrichtendienst. Police never names the BND. They always call it slightly conspirational, just the befriended office.
9:27 a.m. Telecommunication service of the police headquarters take care of connecting the lines. 9:33 a.m. Request for Bavaria 50, whether or not it's possible to get machine guns. 10:05 a.m. The liaison hostess tells the Arabs that the ultimatum must be met by 12 p.m. Otherwise, there would be no mercy.
Same time in the Netherlands. Anki Spitzer is watching TV and has her telephone close by since the early morning.
So you sit there and you cannot believe that this is really happening, you know, because this was our dream. This was his dream. And now he's being taken hostage and they are threatening. And what is going to happen? And then I heard that the Palestinians wanted 236 prisoners out of Israeli prisons. And then they would let them free. So I called the people from the government here in Israel and I said, are you going to do that? And they said, we are not negotiating with terrorists. Never. So I knew that they were not going to do that. But they told the terrorists that if we don't get those prisoners free, we are going to kill an Israeli every hour.
In the meantime, the police have gathered a squad of hundreds.
10:20 a.m. A platoon of the task force moved into the proximity of the house but was sent back into shelter by an order of Police Director Heilmeier and Detective Gleisner.
The television cameras broadcast this detail too, to the whole world. And an hour after the request where the machine guns can be issued, there is a decision. A small decision.
10:20 a.m. Three machine guns are being delivered to Detective Gleisner. So far, there is no instruction to use the weapons.
Shortly before 10:30, a meeting of the top state representatives begins. In a specially cleared room in the Olympic Center with the Minister of the Interior, Hans-Dietrich Genscher, his Bavarian counterpart Merck, Munich's police chief Schreiber, and his deputy Georg Wolf. The chief public prosecutor and several senior public prosecutors, as well as several police and criminal investigation directors.
10:30 a.m. Order of Police Director Heilmeier to give the machine guns to the observation groups.
Meanwhile, the connection hostess, Detective Anneliese Gress, sets about carrying out one of Issa's assignments.
The leader wanted to speak to a Sudanese guy, no matter who. So I went into the house where the Sudanese team lived, but couldn't find one. I told this to one of my colleagues, Mr. Kessler. After about 30 minutes, he returned and had a Sudanese with him. The Sudanese, whom I didn't know, went in the house with the leader. He returned to the outside some minutes later. The few words I heard from my position were in Arabic. The leader did not tell me what they were talking about.
But the Sudanese revealed it to the police, who questioned him immediately afterwards. Turns out it was a member of the Sudanese Olympic delegation, the boxing coach, Mahoud Hashim Ahmed.
Yes, I am the Sudanese who went into the house Connolly Straße on September 5th, 1972. I was standing close by with three of my colleagues and the German police demanded I should go into this house. They were asking there for someone from Sudan. I was going to the apartment door. I asked what they wanted and they said I should bring coffee and food. But I refused, said goodbye, left and returned to my house. I am not aware what went on in the house, but I saw two Arabs armed with machine guns. I have never seen these Arabs before, and I don't know them. I never recognized them in the Olympic Village before. In the house, I have spoken to one of the Arabs. I cannot describe him except of his white hat. The second Arab wore a black hat. I cannot say more about him as well. We were talking in Arabic language. I am the boxing coach of my country. Together with several of my fellow citizens, I will leave Munich in about 10 minutes and return to my country. Together with several of my fellow citizens, I will leave Munich in about 10 minutes and return to my country.
At 10:55 a.m., the head of the manhunt unit repeats the message over the radio that a group of Arabs is attempting to break out. But this turns out to be a false alarm. At 11 a.m., more than 7 hours after the start of the attack, the police command appoints a head of operations for the protective police and one for the criminal investigation department. 10 minutes later, the newly appointed head of the criminal investigation department issues his first order. A detective director is sent to the Olympic Organization Committee to make sure that the television cameras disappear. Television stations from all over the world broadcast everything live from the Olympic Village nonstop. The hostage situation is the worldwide media event.
Eleven twenty-five a.m. State Attorney Heidel calls. He says that an officer of the BND was on his way to the phone surveillance center of the police. This man speaks Arabic and Hebrew.
This time they drop the usual wording with a befriended service and name the Bundesnachrichtendienst BND. The police leadership is under pressure. Police Chief Manfred Schreiber no longer wants to just sit back and do nothing.
11:25 a.m. The commanding officer decides to deploy precision shooters, possibly in civilian clothing, who are given the exact mission of eliminating perpetrators and providing fire protection for the advancing forces. The shooters start to act after radio signal and the cue sunbeam. After the advanced warning, sun shines through, has been received.
Sun looks through. Code for attention. Get ready and aim. Sunbeam is the code for open fire. So this entry carries the time 11:25. And just 2 minutes later, this.
11:27 a.m. Bavaria 53 informs that the Bavaria 54 has to be withdrawn on demand of the Arabs.
Bavaria 53, this is the code for the operational police director. Bavaria 53, this is the code for the operational police director. Bavaria 54, this is the code for the guards that watch the back door. And who now? Have to step back and get out of sight. So, to use the password metaphor, the sun doesn't come through, but dark clouds come up.
11:35 a.m. Just now, the leaders of the Arabic League have landed in Rheims Airport. The people want to start efforts to mediate.
The gentlemen are being driven to the Olympic Village straight away.
It was around 20 minutes before noon when the chief of the Egyptian delegation returned, this time along with a small man of Arabic parentage. As the terrorist told me, the small man was a representative of the Arabic League. The two gentlemen were accompanied again by Dr. Schreiber or Mr. Tröger. I don't remember who of these two. The talk was held in Arabic and I didn't come close. The terrorists told me that as a result of this talk, the ultimatum was extended until 1 p.m. I remember well the time when this negotiation took place because I asked their leader at 11:30 what now would happen, and he replied he could not longer wait. The Israeli government have had enough time to decide. I told him that it was not that easy to get in touch with Israel, and he had to accept that they had to discuss this amongst them first. The terrorist replied that in Israel there were three persons only in charge to make this decision: Moshe Dayan, Golda Meir, and a certain Gerling. He continued that this Moshe Dayan would not miss the people anyhow, and Golda Meir was just stubborn. So he meant they wouldn't accept the ultimatum.
Moshe Dayan, the legendary Israeli defense minister with the eye patch, and Golda Meir, the prime minister. In this, Issa was correct. Israel categorically had refused to release the 200 Palestinian prisoners. And he might have heard what Anki Spitzer heard in the Netherlands as well, on television, broadcast from Israel, from where there was also live coverage.
Then we saw I saw that the special unit, the most experienced unit in the army of Israel, they were at the airport together with Moshe Dayan, you know, which was an icon at that time, you know, the one with the one eye, with the little eye patch on. And they wanted to come to help. And they offered to come immediately because they had more experience. 3 months before, they had this Sabena plane that was hijacked in Israel, and they took everybody out alive, you know. So they offered their help, and they said, do not bring any units to Germany. We don't want any other military from a military different country on German soil. We can handle it ourselves. That's what the Germans said. And take Moshe Dayan out of the picture, because that will make the terrorists very nervous if they see Moshe Dayan, because just a few years before he did the Six-Day War, you know, so.
Back to the Olympic Village, where Anneliese Gress continues to talk with Issa.
I knew that the ultimatum said that at 12 noon, two people should be shot. And then every hour, one more of the hostages, if no one reacted. I asked him where and how he wanted to kill them. He answered that he wanted to bring two hostages in front of the house and let them be shot there. I said he couldn't do that because he would endanger people, spectators and myself. He replied he had to do that, to demonstrate to the world how serious he was and that he wanted his people to be set free. He said he didn't like a bloodshed either, but he made an offer and so he had no choice. He continued saying he wanted to get in the press beforehand and deliver a statement. The press should be present when the hostages get shot. Since now I knew this, I was glad that the ultimatum was extended until 1 o'clock. When he talked, he stressed that he wouldn't extend the ultimatum another time.
The ultimatum was the hardest part, because you think it's almost 12 o'clock. Israel is not going to free these prisoners. So are they going now at 12 o'clock to kill one of the Israelis? And is that going to be Andre?
11:42 a.m. Mission Control decided to form 12 troops, each containing 3 men from regular police and another 3 troops, each containing 3 men from criminal police. The officers received machine guns, helmets, bulletproof vests, sports suits, etc. 11:50 a.m. General request to all. We are looking for volunteers for raiding the object. Announcement and request via radio communication and to all group leaders.
Excuse me? 8 hours after the attack, a call to all police officers in Munich to volunteer to run the raid. 10 minutes before the original ultimatum expired? There are still no units that are ready, no groups that once trained with each other. And at the time, Germany is refusing help from Israel, which had such people ready to leave at the airport. That's exactly the way it is. 4 minutes to 12 and more. The next diary entries suggest that the police leadership does not even know that the terrorists extended their ultimatum.
11:56 a.m. Police President Dr. Schreiber and Munich Major Kronawitter want to negotiate with the terrorists.
Additionally, I have to say that during one of these before noon talks, the terrorists' leader had rejected offers to change hostages against Germans instead. Then they were offered money, no particular sum. He rejected right away.
12 o'clock, noon. Notice from Bavaria 53. Negotiation cancelled without results. Their leaders returned into the house.
To be complete, he told me that he took personal responsibility when he extended the ultimatum. In this context, during the morning hours, I had to book a phone call for him via walkie-talkie. It was for a long-distance call to Tunisia. The number in Tunis was 276277. He said he had to speak to his superior. It took very long until the connection came. And when he left the house later, he told me that no one was there to speak to him. So he didn't receive updated orders from his superiors. I don't know any name of his superiors.
The police leadership is trying to somehow get formations together for an operation.
12:24 p.m. Operation releases order that the female member of the court service, Mrs. Grace, has to be informed immediately about the planned raid so that she can take personal safety measures. 12:25 p.m. Wireless communication. Armed vehicles arrived at the Olympic Quarter.
Sometimes before or after the visit of the man from the Arabic League, I guess it was after, the German Minister for the Interior arrived, Mr. Genscher. With him were Bavarian Minister Merck, Dr. Schreiber, Mr. Tröger, and the aforementioned criminal detectives. This talk was held in front of the house. I didn't listen. Just once, when I came closer, I caught the words, deadline 15 hours. Then the terrorist's leader demanded food. He wanted 20 portions and said it was not for his people since they wouldn't eat anything.
p.m. Alleged TV report. Ultimatum extended until 1 p.m.
Believe it or not, alleged TV announcement. Ultimatum extended to 1 p.m. Time of entry, 12:35 p.m. The police leadership actually knew nothing about the fact that the man from the Arabic League had negotiated an extension of the ultimatum. And his companion, either his own police chief, Schreiber, or the head of the organizing committee, Walter Tröger, had also not passed it on. This is how it looks.
12:35 p.m. Anki Spitzer is on the phone again with the Israeli ambassador in the Netherlands.
I asked the ambassador, why are they not doing something instead of sending police agents on the roofs? I mean, there are so many. You first cut off the electricity or put smoke into the building, or, you know, there are all kinds of things that you can do. Why are they waiting? Well, nobody had an answer. Nobody also knew what they were doing. Not at all.
They, the Germans.
12:45 p.m. Gear to open locked doors arrived. 1:06 p.m. State Secretary Kiesel informs about ultimatum extended until 3 p.m.
Another extension of the ultimatum, now until afternoon.
1:20 p.m. Request about where this interpreter of the BND was. In case of phone call and recording, no chance to translate so far. 1:30 p.m. First State Attorney Amon informs that phone calls just had to be recorded on tape. No interpreter on his way to the police office. So it had been ordered by his superior State Attorney Heinde. 1:30 p.m. Bavaria 53 informs Arab leaders complains that the food promised by Dr. Schreiber didn't arrive.
Food was promised to be delivered at 12:30, but it was not brought until 10 past 2 by Dr. Schreiber, Mr. Tröger, two men dressed like cooks, and the aforementioned criminal detectives. I repeatedly had to remind them because they didn't bring the food timely. The terrorists already became suspicious. They believed some substance could be mixed in. The food was put down in front of the house, 4 meters distance from it. It was packed in several boxes containing plastic bags, lunch packages. In the boxes, there was also milk and yogurt. I knocked at the door, and when the gentleman started to carry the boxes through the door, the leader said no. He sent them away and carried them in by himself. Dr. Schreiber and Mr. Tröger picked a yogurt each and drank it on the side. I assumed they wanted to demonstrate to the terrorists. They then later ate as well.
2:15 p.m. Vice President arrives and reminds. Peril sunray or shoot means start of operation. Peril for pre-alert, sun will break through soon.
After lunch, around 2:30 till 3 p.m., the delegation returned to the house. As I remember, there were the ministers Genscher and Merck, Dr. Schreiber, Mr. Tröger, and the aforementioned detective. I went to the door and knocked at it. The leader came close. They held a talk next to the door. I didn't hear any of it because Dr. Schreiber took me apart and asked me about what happened in the meantime.
So the afternoon drags on. The ultimatum is extended again to 5 p.m. Groups of policemen are moved back and forth. Machine guns are brought in small portions, sometimes 4, sometimes 11. At one point, the slogan is issued over the radio. The sun is breaking through. Hectic radio calls follow. The order is withdrawn.
K groups informed that Dr. Schreiber is about to negotiate again. Therefore, no action permitted.
Officers complain over the radio about the many TV cameras. Nothing happens. Around 4 p.m., the Bavarian Minister of the Interior is said to be considering whether the remaining Olympic competitions of that day can be cancelled. Yes, indeed. During the whole day, all competitions had been held as scheduled, as if it had been a normal Olympic day. Around this time, the Hong Kong Olympic delegation notices that 2 of its members are missing. After much back and forth, it turns out that they are holed up in their apartment, which is above the Israeli apartment. The terrorists allow the 2 to leave. 4:30 p.m., half an hour before the 5 p.m. ultimatum expires, they say again, sun breaks through slowly and is immediately withdrawn. Merck and Schreiber would still negotiate, and not only them.
Between 3 and 5 p.m., a certain Mr. Sheffey came by without further notice. I later learned that he was Egyptian and representative of any official entity here in Munich. This man spoke in Arabic with the terrorists. Now, when I am reflecting about this, I remember that this took place after 5 o'clock, because later, around 8 o'clock, the leader asked where this Mr. Sheffey was. I went to Mr. Ruprecht, who was available for me at all times, and asked for Mr. Sheffey. I was told that he returned to the Sheraton Hotel. If urgently necessary, he could be taken by car, which would last around 30 minutes. When I reported this to the leader, he said this might not be necessary since this would take until 8:30.
And even more Arabic negotiators arrive.
It could have been as well between 3 and 5 o'clock when the Tunisian ambassador visited the terrorists. He was accompanied by several gentlemen, maybe again Dr. Schreiber and Mr. Tröger. They used a language I didn't understand.
Arrived.
After a couple of minutes, the gentleman left.
State Secretary Kiesel informs about ultimatum extended until
3
p.m.
Same after he spoke to Mr. Sheffey.
There was indeed another expert who came traveling to Munich trying to access the crisis staff. But no one of the Munich police or the German authorities let him in. Just no one. Who he was? The chief of the Israeli Mossad. Anki Spitzer knows the detail.
The only one that went to Munich was the head of the Mossad. And he took with him the head of the investigation of the Mossad, because he was the one that did the negotiations with the Arabs with this Sabena plane 3 months before. And he was very successful and he spoke Arabic. So he took him with him, and they were totally ignored by the Krisenstab, you know, the crisis staff that were supposed to handle the situation. They didn't want to take them. They didn't want to talk to them. They didn't want to explain to them, because I've been many, many, many times in touch with the head of the Mossad. He said it was unbelievable. They just didn't want us to be there. And we said we can maybe help. Maybe you have to tire out these terrorists, all kinds of things that they had done in the past and that which were successful. They forgot to take them. They forgot to tell them, you know, unbelievable. And they were so frustrated because they said, still, we had some more experience. And they didn't have a plan at all because the head of the Mossad, Zvi Zamiri, asked several times, I said, what is your plan? What are you going to do? And everybody looked at each other and they just did like this with their shoulders. They pulled up their shoulders. They had no clue. They had no plan. So here we are waiting, and suddenly I'm sitting in front of the TV.
5 o'clock, the ultimatum had expired again. The members of the crisis staff came along again. Issa joined them again. Negotiations again.
To describe what happened in the afternoon, I have to start with the arrival of Minister Genscher around 5 o'clock. He was accompanied by Minister Merk and the other gentlemen. I could not follow their talks from the beginning. I came close when the terrorists' leader said that there was a proposal provided by the Israeli hostages. It said that they all, meaning the terrorists and the hostages, should get on a plane to Cairo, Egypt. Israel also should bring the 200 Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli prison to Cairo. They then should be all released draw by draw. The minister doubted that this proposal came from the Israeli hostages. So 3 of the hostages were brought to the window. First, there was Mr. Gutfreund and confirmed in German language that this was the wish of the Israelis. Then came André Spitzer and Mr. Stroch. Mr. Spitzer repeated in German language that it was correct that they wanted to fly to Cairo with these gentlemen and they are being released against the Palestinians in exchange. Mr. Stroch confirmed by saying, this is the case. I heard the names Spitzer and Stroch as they mentioned them themselves. During this talk, the terrorist's leader offered to become hostage of Germany and go into a prison to guarantee that this proposal was executed properly. During this talk, the terrorist's leader offered to become hostage of Germany and go into a German prison to guarantee that this proposal was executed properly. His comrades were willing to do this as well. I did not hear someone of the delegation answer to that. Because this was a completely new situation, they agreed to extend the ultimatum until 7 o'clock. It was necessary to inform the Israeli government. They also agreed that one member of the delegation would provide the terrorists with an update until 6:30.
The scene at the window when the hostages are brought before the crisis team is also broadcast live on television, worldwide, also in the Netherlands, where Anki Spitzer follows it in her parents' house.
My only source was the news, the TV, but I also was called by the Israeli ambassador in Holland and also the one in Germany, you know, because I demanded it. And I also called them, you know, I said, what is happening? What is going on? And so on. So here I sit and suddenly at little bit after 5 o'clock, I see that on the second floor, because TV was all the time focused on that building. I see that the window, that the curtain opens and the window opens. Suddenly I see André in front of the window and his hands were tied behind his back and he didn't have his glasses on, which I found very difficult for him because I knew that he couldn't see without his glasses. And he was taken in front of the window because he spoke German and he was like an intermediary between the Krisenstab and with the terrorist. So, I could not hear what they were talking, but I saw him. And later on, after the terrible tragedy happened, I asked the Krisenstab, you know, I said, what was the discussion? I even asked it a month ago of one of the Egyptian observers who was with the Krisenstab. I met him in Munich, in the Olympic Village, a month ago. And he said the conversation was very simple. They asked him, what is the situation inside? And he said everybody is okay except for one. And then they asked him what happened to the one and who is it? And when he wanted to answer, you know, I saw on live television that André was hit with the rifle in his back and they pushed him back into the room. They closed the window, they closed the curtain, and that was really the last time I saw him alive. But at least he was still alive. So it gave me hope. And I said, he is still alive. He is not the one that got killed, because everybody heard the shots also, you know, so they knew something happened there.
Now it seemed to me as if the leader lost confidence. He went into the house and said he would speak with his comrades. He came back after 15 minutes and I was talking with him. When I remarked that he was restless, he said this was not the case. But he had planned to be finished at latest 6 o'clock, so he had been ordered as well. Also, he said he was unsatisfied with how things developed. I also asked him how he anticipated how it should continue if he killed the hostages. He said that in this case, he would take German hostages, so he didn't have to fear anything for himself. Outside of the Olympic Park, several cars with comrades of him would be waiting. No further detail from him. When he then returned into the house, I contacted the guards next and told them they should rapidly go away when it came to action, because he planned to take German hostages.
It then becomes even more chaotic. In Munich, there are several demonstration marches. Solidarity with the Israelis. Some demonstrators threaten to storm the Olympic Village. The police first withdraw forces from the building, then bring them back. A decision is made in the crisis team. Terrorists and hostages are to be taken away from the Olympic Village and to the Fürstenfeldbruck airfield, as discussed with the terrorists. Police Vice President Georg Wolf is to lead the operations there and flies over in a helicopter. Some snipers will also be flown to Fürstenfeldbruck.
Shortly before 6:30, the man became nervous and feared that they had betrayed him. But on time, at 6:30, Minister Genscher and Minister Merk appeared with their entourage. Minister Genscher started a conversation and explained that the Israeli government agreed to the plan in general. Someone objected that now the technical details had to be worked out. At this point, I want to make clear that I didn't listen to the whole conversation. When it came to these technical details, I heard the leader say that they demanded to be flown out within the next hour. Again, someone objected and said that this was not possible that fast. I heard that helicopters were made available to bring them to Fürstenfeldbruck, to the plane to Cairo. The terrorist knew that Fürstenfeldbruck was a military airfield, so the minister calmed him down, saying that it was the Olympic airport at that time. The terrorist asked how he would reach the helicopters. He wanted cars for that. There again came objection that this was not possible and how it could work. Then he asked who would join them for their safety and asked Minister Genscher to do that. He refused due to his high position. Then I offered myself because I knew that I enjoyed his trust. Dr. Schreiber was against it, so it was halfway agreed that possibly two persons would go with them to the helicopter. The Germans asked for more time and they agreed to continue to at latest 9 o'clock. This talk went until 6:50. Then the delegation left and I was alone with the leader again. He said to me that he distrusted these people and that they just might play with him. But things would be better if I would go with them, and for sure no one would do me any harm. He was so pessimistic that he offered a bet. He said his life against 20 Deutsche Mark if nothing serious would happen tonight. Of course, I didn't take the bet, but I saw how nervous he was. I tried to calm him down and explained that a minister for sure would keep his word and everything would turn out to be good.
Five terrorists, a tragic mistake. They were eight terrorists, not five. The police did not correct this mistake, not even later when the terrorists arrived in Fürstenfeldbruck with the hostages. The terrorists are nervous. They are waiting. Terrorist Badran, one out of these three who survived, testified later.
The minister wrote down the names of the Israeli hostages after the Israelis agreed to fly to Cairo with us. We trusted the minister and believed that he would provide a plane. We then waited until 8 p.m., but no one came. Issa contacted the contact lady and demanded that the plane had to be ready no later than 9 p.m. Otherwise, we would chase the hostages all the way to the airport.
Meanwhile, it went dark, and the leader carried his machine gun whenever he came to the door. When I contacted Mr. Ruprecht, he told me to slowly get away. But I couldn't do this right away, because he then would have become even more suspicious. Nevertheless, I started to change my position a bit and be more often with Mr. Ruprecht and one of my colleagues. I had the house still inside. The leader came outside two or three times and I went to him each time. As already explained, he asked for Mr. Chaffee. The other time he just wanted to talk with me to reflect on things. This was the case at 8:50, when Minister Genscher returned with his entourage. Before Genscher could say a word, the leader thanked him and said, "I want to warmly say thank you to the German government. You have been very fair and did all you can." Then I could not hear anything else because I stepped back to my people. I don't know why he thanked the minister. I assume it was because I had told him that he was trustable and would return, which he then did. This was my last contact with the terrorists. I did not follow the last talk with the minister, which took around 20 minutes. After finishing, the terrorist and the minister, accompanied with some other gentlemen, were walking towards the basement of the so-called Bolivia House. After that, I had not seen him again. I was told this walk was a test for the walk to the helicopter.
At around 5 minutes after 9 p.m., the interior minister came with two other men. He said that a bus was waiting for us now, but the bus he was talking about was too small. So we declined. They brought us a bigger one. We never demanded a helicopter to fly to Fürstenfeldbruck, though. When the bus arrived, we left the house with the hostages, who had their hands tied together, and took a bus to three helicopters. After the bus arrived at the helicopters, only Issa stepped out and walked towards one of them. He had his machine gun with him. Collectively, we were 9 Israelis and 8 Palestinians. I was in a helicopter with Issa, 2 comrades and 5 Israelis. Issa was sitting next to the pilot along with one of my comrades. Me and the other comrades were guarding the Israelis. The other helicopter took off first. Ours followed 3 minutes later. There were no problems during the flight. We flew 15 to 20 minutes.
To be continued in the next episode.
Geheimakte 1972, 50 Jahre nach dem Olympia-Attentat in München. Ein Podcast der Antenne Bayern Group.
You like this podcast? Consider writing a review, sharing it with your friends, or clicking like or full 5 stars. You feel you have something to contribute? Contact me via email to geheimakte@antenne.de.